This morning what I want to do is begin a discussion about suffering in the Psalms. To look at the subject of suffering specifically in the context of the Psalms is a little bit different than taking that topic in and of itself and addressing it. I'm anticipating doing, over the next couple of weeks, two or three Psalms that deal with different aspects of human suffering. And today, primarily, I'm going to be giving some introduction and background. I'd planned to do Psalm 44 today. And I started working on the background material and the introduction to that psalm. And I realized at some point in the week there was no way I could say what I wanted to say in terms of introduction and deal with the psalm itself. That's why you don't see Psalm 44 up here. So, I have absolutely no idea if what I'm going to do is going to take 20 minutes or an hour. I promise it won't take an hour because I'll be tired of myself but long before then. This is one of those Sundays where I ended up with someplace I didn't intend to go, and we'll see how it works. As an opening scripture this morning, I want to begin with a New Testament passage. Read you two verses out of 1 Peter chapter 4. You don't need to turn there. I'll simply read them to you. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as if some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exultation. If you're reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. The point here, I think, that Peter's making is that when we deal with any aspect of the teachings of the Bible about human suffering, it has to be looked at against the background of the suffering of Christ. The theological proposition that I want to put forth at the beginning today, and I needed something to write on the board this morning, so I chose to write this. The theological proposition for today's lesson is that the suffering of the righteous is never meaningless, even if we cannot readily discern its purpose. If you want to step back another step and say suffering in general, and I will be talking about suffering in general a little bit, I guess I wrote it that way, is that we're looking at this from the perspective of the psalmists who are believers. The dilemma that we're going to get to today is the conflict between righteous acts and suffering in that context. I decided I'd begin today by reciting some quotes about suffering. I looked around for something appropriate to say, and I found very little, quite frankly, worth repeating. I concluded that suffering must be a subject about which people just don't really know a lot. They haven't got this figured out. I did find one that included a quote by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He wrote in his letters and papers from prison this quote: "We must learn to regard people less in light of what they do or omit to do, and more in the light of what they suffer." I think he meant that the true measure of a man comes out in times of suffering, and if that's his intent, I agree with that. When I restricted my quote to Christian observations on suffering, I found a few more quotes that were more worthy of citing in the lesson. One by Charles Swindoll. Charles Swindoll said, "If you allow it, suffering can be the means by which God brings you his greatest blessings." Tim Keller, a person I've come to admire a lot after reading a few of his books, points out that suffering is actually at the heart of the Christian story. And he's right about that. In his book, The Reason for God, Keller makes the argument that in light of the cross, where God himself bore the suffering for human sin, of all the objections that can be raised about why God allows human suffering, one that cannot be raised is that he doesn't love us. In another book, the name of the book is Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, Keller suggests that when looking at suffering through secular eyes, Suffering is never seen as a meaningful part of life. It's only seen as an interruption. Christianity doesn't look at suffering like the world looks at suffering. For the Christian, unlike the Buddhist, suffering is real. Suffering is not an illusion. For the Christian, unlike the Eastern concept of karma, suffering is often unfair. At least from a human perspective, the balance sheet doesn't always seem to balance. And for the Christian, unlike the secularist, suffering is meaningful. There's a purpose to it. Some of the best people sometimes endure terrible experiences. Job, I suppose, is one that comes readily to mind. Jesus, who in one sense is the ultimate Job, suffered in spite of, if not because of, his innocence. Unlike the secular worldview, where there's no explanation for suffering other than to attribute it to bad luck in a random universe, the Bible deals with suffering, and it doesn't shy away from what some have called the thorniest theological problem in the world. Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, it's not my intent to do the impossible, to give you a quick answer to the problem of suffering. Nothing about suffering is easy. Enduring suffering isn't easy, and even dealing with the question of suffering can be difficult. Many of the Psalms expose the suffering of the authors. John Luther Mays, in a book called The Lord Reigns, a Theological Handbook of the Psalms, writes this. He says, "In the Psalms, the prayers for help are a theological interpretation of suffering. They place the troubles of life in a context of meaning. They provide the way to move affliction out of the realm of merely accidental, fortuitous meaninglessness into the comprehension of a view of self, world, and God." In other words, the Psalms put suffering into a human context. You and I didn't write the Psalms. Historically, they don't reflect the specific experiences in your life or mine. They are experiences from godly men in the dispensation of law. So when we read the Psalms, rather than being participants in the drama, we're really observers. We're spectators looking at the sufferings of the psalmists from a distance. But we're drawn into the drama because we share a common faith with the writers. And we're human and we share similar experiences and we have similar questions. We're able to empathize with the actors in what to them is a real life drama, sort of like we participate in movies when we associate with the actors. We put ourselves in their shoes, and we find in their experiences practical parallels to our own lives. Now, something that I find interesting about looking at suffering in the context of the Psalms is that the psalmists approach the problem of suffering as pragmatists. If you were to set out on a study of this particular topic, the topic of suffering in the context of philosophy, you'd likely find yourself immersed in thousands of pages of philosophical writings that try to answer the question of suffering abstractly. And there's really nothing wrong with that. It would be okay if your interest in suffering is academic. But if you happen to be in crisis, think about it. A patient really doesn't care how the painkiller works. He's just interested in getting the shot. And that's the difference in an abstract and a pragmatic look at suffering. Because the Psalms record the suffering of real people, the answers that tend to emerge from the Psalms are very functional in nature. In the Psalms, we see prayer as a common practical response to suffering. So I want to take a look at suffering over the next few weeks in the Psalms and look at it from the pragmatist point of view, looking for practical answers to the problem of suffering in our lives today as believers. As a starting point, I think there's a principle that we have to understand and accept, and this allows us, I believe, to gain a proper understanding and context for understanding the biblical doctrine of suffering. And the simple statement of the principle is this: the Bible assumes that sin merits punishment and therefore suffering ensues. This principle, though correct, is often misapplied. That's the mistake that Job's friends made. They presumed, because he was suffering, that it was punishment for something he had done wrong, which was not the case. This principle that sin comes into the world and punishment and suffering result does not mean that if you find yourself in a crisis, if you find yourself suffering, that it's punishment for some sin you've committed. That's not necessarily the case. This topic is really a three-sided coin. Here are the three sides. Some suffering is due to the sins of others. Sometimes the righteous suffer simply because someone else has done something evil. This raises, of course, the question of fairness. Why should I suffer because of something someone else did? Another side of this coin, some suffering is indeed the result of sins that the one suffering has committed. Personal sins have consequences, and they sometimes are borne out in the life experiences of the person who committed the misdeed. Then, I guess the third side of this is that in some cases, the psalmists give us no indication or reason for the trials and tribulations that the writers are suffering. They simply seem to be part of life in a fallen world. Sometimes we just don't know why. So these are the three sides of the coin. One side, sometimes suffering occurs to us because of something someone else did. Sometimes suffering occurs to us because of something we did, and sometimes we simply don't know why it occurred at all. When we consider this third proposition, that in some cases we may not know the reason for suffering, I think it's helpful again to turn to Tim Keller and the book he wrote, The Reason for God. He wrote this, "Tucked away within the assertion that the world is filled with pointless evil is the hidden premise that if evil appears pointless to me, then it must be pointless." This, he says, is fallacious. Just because you can't imagine a good reason why God might allow something bad to happen doesn't mean that there isn't a reason. I think that's pretty significant. For you to conclude that God is unfair in the context of suffering, you have to conclude that because you don't understand the reason for the suffering, there can't possibly be a reason. And that's simply not the case. Complicating any discussion of suffering is the age-old paradox that all too often it's the righteous who suffer or the wicked misbehave with apparent impunity. If we saw suffering in the world always in the context of immediate moral justice, we'd have far less problem with it than we do. The problem is that's not how it seems to exhibit itself in the world. A few weeks ago, we studied Psalm 73, and in that psalm, Asaph, who wrote it, was deeply troubled because the wicked seem to prosper while the righteous suffer. If you recall that lesson, Asaph writes, "Here are the wicked, always at ease. They increase their wealth. Surely I, as a righteous man, have kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence for no good reason. For I've been stricken all day long and chastened every morning." That was the problem that suffering brought into the life of Asaph. Seems like it's the wrong people who are suffering. The dilemma was resolved when he compared the destinies of the righteous and the wicked. A few verses later, he goes on to write, "When I pondered to understand this, it was troublesome in my sight until I came to the sanctuary of God. Then I perceived their end, how you cast the wicked down to destruction, how they're destroyed in a moment, how they're utterly swept away by sudden terrors." If we think about Asaph's solution, it doesn't make void the moral principle that we laid out a moment ago, that sin merits punishment. Moral justice is not abandoned by Asaph. But when you look at it from the point of view of the sufferer, that justice may be delayed in time, and it may seem even to fall outside the cause-effect construct. But that's our problem as finite creatures. We don't have all the information. We don't have the full perspective. We don't have even a sufficient perspective to draw conclusions about God's dealings with evil, particularly when that evil begins with a capital E. The premise that sin merits punishment and therefore suffering ensues is a fundamental principle of the Old Testament. There are some words in Ecclesiastes written by Solomon that seem to contradict this proposition, but I think when they're properly understood, they actually support it. In the 7th chapter of Ecclesiastes, Solomon writes, "Do not be excessively righteous and don't be overly wise." Why would you want to ruin yourself? Most commentators agree that he wrote this in a spirit of sarcasm, intending to strengthen the position that righteousness and wisdom are in fact desirable, while they're opposites. A life characterized by sin is destructive. But if we really want to see how this presents itself in the Old Testament, we need to look to the book of Deuteronomy, because it's there that this principle is put forth in its clearest form. Deuteronomy 28 in particular is made up of two parts. Each part is characterized by a particular promise. The first 14 verses include the promise of blessing, contingent upon obedience, and the promise of cursing if Israel is disobedient. What I want to do is, I'm not going to read this chapter, it's 68 verses long, but I'm just going to kind of skip through it. You can look on if you want, or you can just listen. But what I want you to get a sense of here is, God, through Moses, is promising to the people of Israel that if they're obedient, they'll be blessed. And if they disobey him, they'll be cursed. Listen to how he does this. I'll start by reading the first couple of verses. "Now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God." This is interesting language here. God says, if you will obey me, I'll bless you. And the blessings that I'm going to bring on you are so certain that they will actually overtake you. You won't be able to get away from them. You can try, but you won't be able to avoid the blessing that I'm going to bring on you. And then he begins to give some examples in verse 3. "Blessed you shall be in the city, and blessed you shall be in the country." That means it doesn't matter where you go, these blessings are going to track you down, and they're going to overtake you. Verse 4, "Blessed be the offspring of your body, the produce of the ground, the offspring of your beast." You're going to see success in everything that you do. "Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl." You're going to have plenty to eat. "Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out." That means all the time. So what he said here is, I'm going to bless you wherever you are. You can't get away from it. And I'm going to bless you all the time. It's going to be from morning till night. Verse 7 is an interesting verse. "The Lord will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you." There's a promise here of national preservation. Your enemies will be defeated. Listen at this little figure of speech. "They shall come out against you one way, and they shall flee before you seven ways." Chaos. Keep that in mind for a moment. Verse 8, "The Lord will command this blessing upon you." This is a command of God. "It'll occur in your barns. He'll bless you on the land." Verse 9, "The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, as he swore to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways." I said I wasn't going to read all this, but verse 10 is so interesting, I have to mention it. "So all the people of the earth then shall see that you're called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you." Now that's an interesting foreign policy statement. If I had to choose between, if I were the king of America, and I had to choose whether my enemies liked me or whether they were scared to death of me, I'm going with fear. Listen to what God said to Israel. "Your enemies who rise up against you will be afraid of you." Well, what does that mean? It means they're going to stay clear. It makes no sense to make friends with your enemies. The Lord will make you abound in prosperity. Verse 12, the Lord will open up his storehouse for you. Verse 13, the Lord will make you the head and not the tail. Now, I understand that. You don't need to read Hebrew. I'd rather be a head than a tail. Okay? The Lord will make you the head and not the tail. And you shall be above. You shall not be underneath. If you'll listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, which I charge you today to observe fully. Then we come to verse 15. This is where the chapter splits. Now we're going to see what happens if you don't obey. If you do obey, God's blessings are going to be commanded upon you. They're going to find you 24 hours a day, no matter where you go, in every aspect of your life. That's what God promised. Verse 15. But it shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God, to observe to do all of his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses shall come upon you, and guess what? They will overtake you. There's that same word. In the same way the blessings will overtake you if you do what's right, curses will overtake you. You can't get away from them if you do what is wrong. And he starts off just like he did earlier. Curse you shall be in the city, and curse you shall be in the country. Wherever you go, you can't get away from the consequences of disobedience. Verse 17, curse you shall be in your basket and kneading bowl. You're not going to have enough to eat. Curse shall be the offspring of your body, the produce of the ground. Verse 19, cursed you shall be when you come in, and cursed you shall be when you go out. Does that remind you of verse 6? If you obey me, when you come in and go out, you'll be blessed. Blessings will overcome you. If you disobey me, when you come in and you go out, meaning all the time, the curses are going to find you. The Lord will send upon you curses, confusion in all that you undertake. You won't know what you're doing. Keep in mind, he's speaking here to the nation. You ever wonder sometimes if we as a nation know what we're doing? It seems to me that we have the spirit of confusion. Verse 21, pestilence. Verse 22, the Lord will smite you with consumption. Verses 23 and 24 we should be able to understand because we're in a drought. And that's the promise here. The heaven which is over your head shall be bronze. No clouds. That big orange thing up there. And the earth which is under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust. If you know anything about West Texas or Oklahoma, you've heard of the Dust Bowl. That's the promise. And this will continue, it says, until you're destroyed. Verse 25, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before the enemies. You shall go out one way against them, and you shall flee seven ways before them. That's the inverted principle. It's the opposite of verse 7. Verse 27, the Lord will smite you with the boils of Egypt. Verse 28, he'll smite you with madness and blindness. Verse 30, you shall betroth a wife, but another man shall violate her. She'll build a house, but you won't live in it. Plant a vineyard, won't eat grapes. Your ox shall be slaughtered before your eyes, but you shall not eat of it. Your donkey will be taken away from you, and you won't be recompensed for it. Your sheep will be given to your enemies. You'll have nothing. Your sons and your daughters will be given to another people while you watch, and there'll be nothing you can do about it. People whom you don't know shall eat up the produce of your ground. You shall be driven mad by the sight of what you see. Verse 36, the Lord will bring you and your king, whom you shall set over you, to a nation neither you nor your fathers have known. Promise of exile. You shall become a horror and a proverb. Things will be so bad for you that you'll become a proverb on the lips of people for generations after. Verse 38, you shall gather in little, and the locust shall consume it. You shall plant and cultivate vineyards. Don't count on drinking wine. Verse 43, the alien who is among you shall rise above you higher and higher, but you shall go down lower and lower. If you can read this next verse and not think about China, good luck. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. All of these curses shall come on you and pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed. Verse 48, you shall serve your enemies. Verse 49, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, a nation whose language you'll not understand. Isaiah, who was contextually in the same time that I think Psalm 44 was written, similar time, picks up this whole thing in Isaiah chapter 28. It's very interesting to look at that. A nation of fierce countenance will have no respect for the old, show no favor to the young, will become your enemy. Verse 58. If you're not careful to observe the words of this law which are written in the book to fear, then the Lord will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants. Verse 63. The Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples. Verse 66, your life will hang in doubt before you. And in verse 68, the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships. In other words, you'll revert back to the time before you were even a nation. It's pretty clear that obedience to the law will bring blessing, and disobedience will bring cursing. So this is important. Wake up. If you know this scripture, Deuteronomy 28, and similar scriptures, what would you believe your lot should be if you're obedient to the laws and statutes of the Lord? Would you expect blessings and all the good things from verses 1 through 14? Or would you expect curses that we read about in verses 15 through 68. Which would you expect? You do everything right. What did God promise? Blessing. Now let's take a look at how this worked out for one of Israel's kings. Here I'll give you a hint of kind of what I'm thinking. Over the next 2 or 3 weeks, I want to look at least 3 Psalms which address suffering from the 3 perspectives we laid out a moment ago. Suffering that results from the sins of others, suffering that results from personal sins of the one suffering, and instances where suffering is not attributed to either of the above categories, but is simply part of life in a fallen world. Psalm 44 is an example of a psalm where the suffering is not due to the sins of the one suffering, but results instead from the sins of others. In other words, it's category 1 suffering. Before we can begin the exegesis of Psalm 44, though, I need to give you a little historical background. There's no definitive agreement on the date that Psalm 44 was written, but it was written, no one disagrees about this, it was written at a time of national crisis, a time of pending military disaster. If its placement in the Psalter is any indication of its historical context, and I believe it is, it seems that Psalm 44 may have been composed during the time of King Hezekiah. Why do I say that? Well, the very next psalm, Psalm 45, is thought to be Hezekiah's wedding song. And Psalms 46, 47, and 48 deal specifically with the Assyrian invasion, which would argue for a time period when Hezekiah was king of Judah. So the grouping of these Psalms, 44 through 48, may be an indication that we should put Psalm 44 at the end of the 8th century BC or the beginning of the 7th century BC. If that's the case, then we need to take a few minutes and become acquainted with Hezekiah. 2 Kings 18 through 20 is a record of events that took place during the reign of King Hezekiah. If you don't know who he was, Hezekiah was one of the good guys. His name is written 2 different ways in the Hebrew text. It's written Hizkiyah, meaning Yah has strengthened. Whenever you see that syllable Yah, Y-A-H, it's a short abbreviation for Yahweh. So, Hizkiyah, one of the ways his name is written, means Yah has strengthened. It's also written Hizkiyahu, which means Yah has strengthened him. Hezekiah is the son of wicked Ahaz, one of the worst, if not the worst, of Judah's kings. So Hezekiah is a southern kingdom king. Okay, this puts him in Judah. He's a southern kingdom king. It appears that he was a ruler, at least a co-regent, with Ahaz for a few years. I'm not sure how many years, but as his father declined in health, he came up and he was co-regent or co-king, vice king, however you want to think about it, with his father. But in about 715 BC, Hezekiah had full rule of from the throne of Judah. So he was co-regent, and then from about 715 to right around 687 BC, he was the king. If you look into the Jewish literature, Hezekiah is one of three kings said to have avoided committing trespass. Now, the other two kings are David and Josiah. Josiah, by the way, also a southern kingdom king, is the great-grandson of Hezekiah. Now, this plays to something that you mentioned a moment ago. There are no good people. Mike mentioned earlier today that there were no good people. And yet, there are times that you're going to see in the Psalms claims of righteousness. They're not claims of absolute moral righteousness, but they are an indication that the individual, usually the king, generally walked in the will of Yahweh, not promoting national idolatry and not promoting alliances with foreign power. David often claimed to have done nothing to merit the suffering that he was encountering. Now, we know David was a sinner. All men are. So when we see kings or psalmists attributing righteousness to themselves, they're not trying to make a statement about absolute moral purity. What they are doing is they are saying that their heart was in the right place. We know that David's was. And so was Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a lot like David, and he was a lot like Josiah. Now, Hezekiah had a son. His son is named Manasseh. Manasseh did not follow in the footsteps of his father. He rather followed in the footsteps of his grandfather, Ahaz, and he became a willing vassal king of the Assyrian Empire. Historically, while we're in the era of Manasseh and Hezekiah and Ahaz, we have over here in the east the Assyrian Empire growing dramatically in power and imposing its will on the Levant, or the Middle East, where Israel is located. It's not surprising to me that the name Manasseh means causing to forget, because he forgot the ways of Hezekiah, meaning he did not practice the principles of his father. The chronicler, if we look in Chronicles, says this about Manasseh. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abomination of the nations whom the Lord had dispossessed before the sons of Israel. That's the 33rd chapter of 2 Chronicles. But an interesting thing happened. After being captured and hauled off to Babylon by the Assyrians, and that's attested for us in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 11, Manasseh did what he should have done as a young man. He entreated the Lord, and he humbled himself greatly. Listen to what the text says in 2 Chronicles 33, verses 12 and 13. When he, Manasseh, was in distress, when he was suffering, he entreated or prayed to Yahweh his God, and he humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. When he prayed to him, God was moved by his entreaty, or by his prayer, and he heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem, to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that Yahweh was God. It's my opinion, but I think this is a late-in-life personal conversion experience on the part of Manasseh that resulted very specifically from the suffering that Manasseh encountered at the hands of the Assyrians. So we have Hezekiah sandwiched in between evil Ahaz, and his son Manasseh, who spent most of his life rebelling against the reforms of his father. 2 Chronicles 33:2 tells us that Manasseh did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. But Hezekiah, unlike his father and unlike his son, was a faithful man. 2 Kings 18:5 says, Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. So after him there was none like him among the kings of Israel. If you could only remember one thing about King Hezekiah, it's this. Hezekiah was a reformer. As the son of and co-regent of Ahaz, who was evil, Hezekiah saw firsthand how the kingdom should not be run. You can imagine how upside down things were spiritually in Judah under Ahaz, and Hezekiah knew that something had to change. We look back from our perspective on the Protestant Reformation as a time when the apostate church was reintroduced to the gospel of grace by great men such as Luther and Zwingli and Tyndale and John Calvin. Hezekiah was a lot like these men. And 2 Chronicles 29-31 is a record of a series of reforms that Hezekiah put in place in Judah. If I may, I'm going to turn back to chapter 29 of 2 Chronicles and just read you the first 5 verses of that chapter. Hezekiah became king when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. He did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. So he's compared here to David. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Now you have to understand what his father had done. Ahaz had brought in Canaanite deities into the temple. He had polluted the temple. They were actually burning incense to Canaanite deities in the temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Verse 4. Hezekiah brought in the priests and the Levites, and he gathered them on the square in the east. And he said to them, "Listen to me, O Levites, consecrate yourself now, and consecrate the house of the Lord, the God of your fathers, and carry the uncleanness out from the holy place." The uncleanness refers to the idols and all of the instruments of worship for these idols that Ahaz had brought into play. Hezekiah begins his reforms by ordering the priests to prepare themselves for service and to prepare the temple for service. The consecration of the temple, which was polluted with idols by Ahaz, and the consecration of the priests was the first step in reinstituting worship in accordance with the Mosaic law. Look at verse 23 of this chapter, chapter 29 of 2 Chronicles. Then they, the priests, brought the male goats of the sin offering before the king and the assembly, and they laid their hands on them. The priests slaughtered them and purged the altar with their blood to atone for all Israel. For the king, that's King Hezekiah, ordered the burnt offerings and the sin offering for all of Israel. So Hezekiah then, he purges the temple. He has the priests consecrate themselves, and then he orders them to offer a sin offering on behalf of the people. The next thing he does is he reinstitutes the Passover. Israel's not been observing the Passover. Look at verse 30, verse 1. Now Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and he wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh, they were up north, tribes, that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover to the Lord God of Israel. So under Hezekiah's reforms, Israel is beginning to look a lot like Israel. That didn't look like Israel for a long time. Then we come to chapter 31. And we find out in the first verse of that chapter that he tore down all of the idols and places of worship of these Canaanite deities. Now when all this was finished, all this purification, all the sacrifices had been made, all Israel who were present went out to the cities of Judah. They broke down the pillars in pieces and cut down the Asherim and pulled down the high places and the altars throughout all Judah and Benjamin. These are the places where all this idolatry was taking place. They also did this in Ephraim and Manasseh, and those are two tribal land allocations up north. Then all the sons of Israel returned to their cities, each to his possession. The last thing he did, we see over in 2 Kings chapter 18. I'll just read a few verses from the beginning of that chapter. Some of these are repetitive. Now, it came about in the third year of Hoshea. Hoshea was a northern king. He was an evil king. As Mike's pointed out, there were no good ones up there. And he sort of parallels the last part of the reign of Ahaz and the first part of the reign of Hezekiah. And if I remember correctly, there was one king after Hoshea in the north, and I think it was Pekah. I'm sure Steve remembers from memorizing all those kings in seminary. I think it was Pekah. Anyway, in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, and here Israel is used to mean the northern kingdom. He was the king of the northern kingdom. Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, became king of Judah. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Avi. You remember over there earlier, her name was Abiyah. This is a short form. This is just an abbreviation. It's like Abigail or Abby. Same person, daughter of Zechariah. This king, Hezekiah, did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places, broke down the sacred pillars, cut down the Asherah. And listen at this. This is why I turned here. And he also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the sons of Israel burned incense to it, and it was called Nehushtan. Now, this is interesting. This symbol, which Jesus used later in the New Testament to symbolize his own crucifixion, it had become an idol itself. They had been burning incense to this, and they called it Nehushtan. It's an interesting word. If you look at the consonants in that word, the N, the H, and the SH are the consonants for the word snake. The N, the H, the SH, and the T are the consonants for the word brass or bronze. So this is really means this piece of bronze that, and it's a play on words between the word for bronze and the word for snake. So he destroyed it. He ground it up and he got rid of everything that was being worshipped in Israel or in Judah. So here we have Hezekiah. He's a man who did things right. He removed the idolatrous high places. He broke down the images of the pagan deities. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel. He clung to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments, according to 2 Kings 18:6. And he reestablished proper worship in Jerusalem and reinstituted the Passover celebration. Now, who thinks that was pretty good? That's pretty good, right? So, this means Hezekiah and his faithful subjects lived lives steeped in the blessings of Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, and experienced none of the bad things from the latter part of Deuteronomy 28, right? All blessings all the time? No. That, by the way, in a moment is going to become the problem. Well, there was a man named Sennacherib. He was the king of Assyria. He reigned from 704 to 681 BC, overlapping the reign of Hezekiah by about 18 years. He was the son of Sargon II, and he was the father of Esarhaddon. Sennacherib ruled the Assyrian Empire that had its capital in Nineveh. And in 701 BC, in the 14th year of Hezekiah, the very time Hezekiah was doing all the things Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14 told him he should do, Sennacherib invaded Judah and he captured 46 cities and he displaced 200,150 citizens of Judah. That doesn't sound like blessing to me. It doesn't sound like Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14. It sounds like Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 68. Seems like just about every week I read about two articles. I could read 10, but I read two. telling me how the Bible is unreliable, that it's a work of fiction. They usually base these articles on this premise, that there's no information out there that could be called reliable third-party information that supports anything in the Bible. That's their argument. Bible can't possibly be true because we don't have any information out there that parallels anything in the Bible. It's just all fantasy. Of course, their position on this is pure fantasy. So I want to take a minute. I want to read something to you from the annals of Sennacherib. Not the Bible. This is a document you can, it's a tablet. You can go to the British Museum and translate the cuneiform text and see how it balances out with the Bible. I want to start by reading you one verse out of 2 Kings, verse 13. It just is an introduction to some stuff you can read yourself later. But here it says, "Now in the 14th year of Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah, and he seized them." Now the next chapter or two goes through all the details. Listen to what the annals of Sennacherib say, and this will take a minute, and then I'll let you go. "As for Hezekiah the Jew," what do you know? Here's a biblical character referred to in the Assyrian documents. "As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity, and I conquered them by means of a well-stamped earth ramp and battering rams brought thus near to the wall, combined with the attack of foot soldiers using mines, breaches, as well as sapper work." I have no idea what that is. "I drove out 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small cattle, beyond the ability to count, and considered them spoils of war. As for Hezekiah, I made him a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence. He was like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city. His towns, which I plundered, I took away from his country, and I gave them over to Metenti, king of Ashdod, Pade, king of Ekron, and Silabel, king of Gaza. Thus I reduced his country, but I still increased the tribute and the Khatru presence due me as his overlord, which I imposed later upon him beyond the former tribute to be delivered annually." In other words, he came in, he did all this stuff to Hezekiah, and Hezekiah is paying tribute to the king of Assyria. "Hezekiah himself, whom the terror-inspiring splendor of my lordship," Sennacherib was a little arrogant, "whom the terror-inspiring splendor of my lordship had overwhelmed, and whose irregular and elite troops which he had brought to Jerusalem, his royal residence, in order to strengthen it, had deserted him, did send me later to Nineveh, my lordly city, together with 30 talents of gold, 800 talents of silver, precious stones, antimony, large cuts of red stone, couches inlaid with ivory, Nemidu chairs inlaid with ivory, elephant hides, ebony wood, boxwood, and all kinds of valuable treasures of his own, including his daughters, concubines, male and female musicians, in order to deliver the tribute and to do service to me. Thus he sent a slave, his personal messenger." So here we have a third-party source giving you a Sennacherib's point of view on what happens here in the subsequent verses and chapters of 2 Kings 18 through 21 and Isaiah 36 and 37. The Bible agrees with the third-party evidence, and we can conclude that the Old Testament story of Sennacherib's invasion of Judah is historically accurate. And we see in this story a good man who suffered because others sinned. You'll be happy to know the next word on my notes is conclusion. Sometimes in the face of evil, godliness exacts a price that from our limited human perspective seems unfair. This was the lot of Hezekiah. Sennacherib invaded Judah, and he devastated the land and the people. Samaria had already fallen to the Assyrian Sargon II, probably during Hezekiah's co-regency with Ahaz. So before Hezekiah was in a position to begin his reforms, if you want to think of it this way, the dice had already been thrown. For all the righteous acts done by Hezekiah, all that really came of them, from a human point of view, was a delay of the Babylonian captivity. The Lord promised Hezekiah 15 additional years of life, and he promised him that the exile would not occur during his lifetime. Even Josiah, Hezekiah's great-grandson, who also did what was right in the sight of the Lord, only saw judgment delayed, but not averted. To anyone living in Hezekiah's day, the rewards of righteousness would have been difficult to discern, for the land was devastated, the people lost their homes, and they lost their homeland, at least for a time. Persecuted believers then and now may be required to pay a high price for faithful obedience. And it may seem, in fact, that there's no reward for it at all. But immediate earthly reward is never the proper motivation for godliness. In fact, if that's how we view faithfulness to God, we're making at least two errors. We're pursuing godliness for selfish reasons, that is, for immediate personal gain, and we're focused on the wrong place, planet Earth, when our eyes should be on heaven. There's also the small matter of human viewpoint versus divine viewpoint. From our New Testament perspective, we can see, looking back, that Hezekiah's reforms set the stage for Israel's worship and faithfulness after they came back from the captivity. The Torah, the written scriptures, were preserved by those who followed faithfully in the footprints that Hezekiah put in the sand through his reforms. The Jews who came back to the land from Babylon were the beneficiaries of the reforms of Hezekiah, just as we are the beneficiaries of the faith and work of the reformers of the Protestant Reformation. Every time we pick up a commentary or a theology book, we're tapping into the lives of faith that preceded us. We benefit from the sufferings of Hezekiah and his contemporaries, sufferings that were not the result of his personal sins. It came because of the sins of others, sins of Ahaz, the sins of his predecessors, the sins of Sargon II, the sins of Sennacherib, and others. Hezekiah's experience meets the requirements for the first category of suffering, and I believe the Assyrian invasion was the occurrence or the occasion for the writing of Psalm 44. So Psalm 44, when we look at it next week, and that's what we're going to do, it's going to be a psalm where suffering has come into the life of the psalmist in exactly the same way that we see this dilemma with Hezekiah. Hezekiah, this is in the Hezekiah section of the Psalms, and I think his history and his background, which I hope you've gotten a little bit of a piece of it today, I think is the background both historically and theologically for Psalm 44. So next week we'll take that up and do the exegesis. Any questions in closing?